This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Baffling news this week. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner reportedly tried to get multiple people to run for governor instead of him, even talking to potential substitutes as late as last summer in the middle of a campaign. State Senator Jason Berrican finds this baffling.
It's not the way the process works. Incumbent governors don't get to select their replacement.
More from Senator Berrican about the GOP recovery from Governor Rauner's 4 years. Plus, the Illinois Symphony Orchestra has its Pops concert this weekend in Bloomington. Eric Stock reports on Bloomington schools. And Mary Cullen looks at why a small business advocacy group is big into political districting reform. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. State Senator Jason Berrican's eyebrows went up this week at the startling news that even as late as last summer, in the middle of the political campaign, Governor Bruce Rauner was seeking someone to replace him on the Republican Party ticket. Berrican came to the GLT studios this morning, joined by his kids Augie and Wally. During the conversation, Berrican condemned Rauner's behavior.
You know, this is one of those stories that makes you scratch your head and shake it negatively. You know, there's so much to unpack from here. First of all, it's not the way the process works. Incumbent governors don't get to select their replacement, whether that replacement is to serve as governor or to be candidate, you know, a nominee from the Republican Party. There's a process at play. And that process is important because it gives a voice to Republican voters. That's what the primary election is for. And so the notion that Bruce Rauner decided he may step back and handpick his preferred choice it's disingenuous at best. It cheats, most importantly, it cheats Republican voters from their opportunity to have a say in this, and that's their voice that gets shut out.
And if he was going to do that, why not just go with Jeannie Ives?
And it begs even beyond Jeannie Ives, it begs the question, you know, Republicans, any voters, we don't do these things because it's, you know, participate in political activities because it's a social outlet. We do it because we care about the public policies. And so for thousands of Republican voters, whether they were for Rauner or for Ives or they're for limited government, they want to participate in this, they get a say in this. There's a lot at stake. The policies that we stand for, the opportunity to sit at the table for the 10-year redistricting process, and Bruce Rauner's comments totally diminish the importance of those things. And, you know, it's a slap in the face to Republican voters, whatever side they were on, the Ives or Rauner, it's a slap in the face to them that his heart wasn't in this thing.
Even if he's not devoted to representational government as chosen by voters of the respective parties in going to the primary and picking their nominees, what does it say about his knowledge of the process that he would be even trying that in the middle of a campaign?
The process. And, you know, and people sometimes hear process and they think, oh, well, you know, that's just, you know, that's like classroom talk. The process is critical. The process determines how parties put forward candidates. The process determines how a bill becomes a law. And this is another example of Rauner's failure to acknowledge or understand the process for how we select candidates for governor. I think is indicative of his lack of understanding of the legislative process to change the law.
But how do you stay involved in state government for one full term and the campaign time before that and not learn this process? How can you go through it and not get it?
You know, it's hard to say. And, you know, this is one of the challenges. I get it. The electorate, and this is around the country, the electorate has desired folks who are not part of the political system because they're frustrated with that system and they think someone from the outside, you know, can shake it up, the mantra of the initial runner campaign. The reality is some people understand the process better than others. And I don't know. I think, you know, Rauner's background as, you know, an investment banker and CEO suggests that he's familiar with a process where he calls all the shots. And, you know, people talk about this notion that running for governor is like becoming CEO of the state. And that's just a woefully inaccurate description of the job. No one's the CEO of the government. He's governor, and with the governor comes a job and responsibility that I think he just never fully grasped. Part of that job is to involve yourself in the legislating process. Even though he doesn't get a vote in it, he can influence it. As an example, I think Governor Rauner let that legislative process play itself out on its own rather than involving himself in it. And then he, you know, he kind of sat back from the outside and cast judgment after the fact. Well, it's more involved than that. Just like there's more involvement in who the candidate is for either party to be the nominee for governor. You don't just pick, someone just doesn't pick them. There's no kingmakers. There's a process to it.
How does the Republican Party in Illinois move on from the governor with this baffling final note to his tune?
Well, I think people are turning their attention towards 2019, new administration. For Republicans, you know, there's been a lot of news about the negatives of the election cycle, and it was harsh on Illinois Republicans, particularly in the suburbs, but for the party throughout. As I look at 2019, I see, you know, a couple scenarios, half glass full, half glass empty. I think we have to work with the Pritzker administration where we can, and I think we will find some common grounds together. You look at a capital program, an investment in our state's infrastructure as an opportunity for the two sides to work together, and that's part of the healing process for the party, right, is moving forward and continuing to engage in the state's governance. I also think that given what Pritzker campaigned on and the, you know, this progressive movement that seems to exist within the Illinois Democratic Caucus, I think that Pritzker will likely overreach. And when he overreaches, I think that's an opportunity for Republicans to hold him accountable. And in doing so, holding him accountable, speaking up for reasonable mainstream people throughout the state, and beginning to rehabilitate ourselves as a party and with voters who I think are frustrated, you know, for lots of reasons at this time.
Surely you don't hope he overreaches.
I don't hope he overreaches, and I'm very sincere in that. I hope he's successful. Now, some of the things that he wants to be successful in are things that I don't believe in, right? And so I plan to speak up on those. But on the challenges facing our state, much of which is financial, we need a governor who's successful. We need a governor who can lead. It's the same thing I've been talking about for, you know, a long amount of time under Rauner. The reality is our state hasn't had an effective governor who leads our state in the way that it needs for over a decade. And so that's an opportunity for Pritzker. I'm concerned, based on what I heard in the election, that he may overreach, but I want him to be successful in not in some of the policies, which are the answers that he put forward to the state's problems. I want him to be successful in wrestling our state's problems, and I'll work with him on that, seek to find common ground. The question becomes, will he seek that middle ground, or will he overreach?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest today is State Senator Jason Barrickman of Bloomington. One of the areas that is an opportunity is a capital bill. Governor-elect Pritzker has said it's going to be not a quick process. Is that a hopeful sign that he's saying, not saying, oh, we're going to get right on this and we're going to pass something quickly and it'll be great for the state of Illinois?
Yeah, I think there's this is one of those areas where there's lots of questions, right? I mean, I think at a high level we would all say, absolutely, there's a need in our state for a capital bill for an investment in our state's infrastructure. I certainly believe in that strongly. How you do it, where those dollars go, and ultimately where those dollars come from are critical questions that have got to be answered first.
Where do you think the likely revenue sources are for this?
Well, you know, Pritzker's outlined some scenarios. You know, we heard about them in the campaign. It may have been legalizing cannabis. It may be gas tax. It may be gaming. I don't know where he's going to, draw lines in the sand. I've certainly shared with you and your listeners, you know, some of my perspectives on some of those ideas, cannabis in particular. And my willingness to...
Even if cannabis goes at the upper level, though, of the revenue estimates, it's not going to provide enough for a capital bill.
Yeah, well, and this is where the leadership becomes necessary, right? Pritzker sits at the top of this heap of legislators who are like sheep. Sheep are tough to herd. The legislating process is one where you have to herd the sheep, listen to voices from all around the state, and cobble that together in a manner that lets you generate the revenue necessary to do the program. I don't know where we'll land on that. I'll have my own perspective on each of those, and we'll work through them as they become, you know, more publicized and clear.
Gas tax is an early and often mentioned option. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, you know, Rahm Emanuel came out the other day and he says, let's, you know, raise the gas tax 20 to 30 cents. I think there's some steps that have to happen before you go there. You know, steps would include a few years ago, by an amendment to the Constitution, we created a lockbox saying that the dollars generated from the gas tax should go specifically towards our roads. I think we need to look at that first. Where, you know, what has happened since that constitutional amendment has been in place? Is there, in fact, not enough money now to go around? Are there ways in which we can spend gas tax money more efficiently, which allows you to stretch the dollar a little more? These are some of the questions that I think get answered through a spring legislative cycle. That's part of what that process is for.
The Cook County Public Guardian this week sued the state of Illinois DCFS for its treatment of children with mental health issues in holding them in facilities far beyond the point where they should have been discharged, either foster care or some lower level stepped facility. The Center for Human Services in McLean County has stopped taking new patients for mental health services because of cuts over the years. One of the suit points in the Cook County Public Guardian's legal action is about the persistent and decades-long cuts to the foster care system and to the state disinvestment in mental health services. Do you believe the state should change course and reinvest in this area of policy?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's certainly something that we will explore. You know, I think the challenge that I think is becoming more clear to the public is the reality that there's not a place for some of these children to go. Now, how we answer that question likely is a further investment.
Or is it funding for locally based services, which has been the traditional Republican policy preference, although not backed up with money?
Well, and that, I guess, but that's where I'm going, is the further investment, I think, is critical to this. So, I've long felt that the answer to, you know, some of these questions comes from local solutions, right? Service providers in communities who are in tune with the needs and able to provide that service. But there's a state role here, and that state role is to help deliver some of those dollars. Now, that's not easy to do in any climate, let alone ours. But again, I think that will be part of it. And this, some of this has hit us at home, right? But I think this will be part of the budgeting process that we, you know, where we set some of these priorities and try, you know, you try to address, to put some solutions forward to these, you know, known problems like these.
State Senator Jason Barrickman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for putting up with the whole Barrickman family today.
They're charming. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Merry Christmas, Mom.
And a Happy New Year!
State Senator Jason Barrickman's kids had a late start day at school and joined him in the studio.
Support for GLT comes from Bloomington Public Library, where books are just the beginning. The library offers different winter break crafts daily, December 27th to 29th and January 2nd to the 4th. Also at 2 o'clock on January 2nd, Red Raccoon Games will teach kids ages 9 to 13 the Pokemon card game. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, District 87 considers lacrosse, perhaps, and suffers a property tax reverse. Eric Stock has more. For the 10th year, the Multicultural Leadership Program in McLean County is partnering with the Bloomington Normal organizations in need of marketing, fundraising, and expanding services. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with MCLP Executive Director Linda Bolivar about which nonprofits the class of 2019 is helping.
Tell me a little bit about what the Multicultural Leadership Program is.
Sure. The Multicultural Leadership Program is a local nonprofit. We are in our 10th year of leadership development. So every year we take a cohort of local leaders who would like to improve their leadership skills. And July through March, they attend two learning events per week. They have mentors, they work on community projects, and they develop a lot of skills and network to become better leaders at work, in the community, and at home.
So every year, like you said, they choose a project. And what are this year's projects that you're working on in the class?
Sure. And I'll tell you, they don't actually get to choose the project. We assign it to them, which sometimes is an interesting challenge. So based on the assessments we do, we assign them to teams to be as diverse as possible. Then meanwhile, we have a team of volunteers who takes requests for proposals from local nonprofits and selects a diverse group of projects. So this year, the nonprofits we have are 261 Fearless, Home Sweet Home Ministries, Salvation Army, and the Vladimir Canterbury Sister Cities Association.
First off, how did you select those four organizations for this year?
The team of volunteers that we have that does that, they're called the Community Involvement Team, and it's made up mostly of alumni from the program. So they look at the proposals and look at what fits in nicely with our September to March timeline, because these get submitted in June. So it's something that would work nicely in September to March, work with a team of 4 to 5 individuals, and make an impact in the community. So something that would be sustainable. We also look at diversity so that in 1 year, for example, we don't have 4 plans that are all fundraising. So we want to have a variety of plans each year, or projects each year.
So let's get into those projects a little bit. So first off, 261 Fearless. Can we talk a little bit about who this is and what this group does?
Yes, 261 Fearless is a small local nonprofit that I was not familiar with till we got the proposal. And the name comes from the woman who was the first woman to sign up for the Boston Marathon. And that was back when the marathon was only for men. And she went by her first initial, so that's how she signed up for the race. And when one of the race organizers learned there was a woman in the race, he actually tried to physically pull her out of the race and rip her number off of her. And so that's the significance of the 261. That was her number. And incidentally, she ended up really winning over this race organizer, and they became friends. But she started this international organization called 261 Fearless, or it's named in her after her, which is empowerment for women based on running. So it's not a running club that is necessarily for competition. It's not to be the fastest, but it's to bring women together together through the empowerment of physical activity.
So then what is going on in MCLP in order to support that organization?
Well, this is an international organization, and locally we have a small group that is trying to grow their organization. So we thought this would be a great opportunity for our team to help them look at a marketing plan. So to look at who's in the club, what draws them to it, look at potential membership, develop a marketing plan so that we can grow this. So we know there are a lot of opportunities for exercise and running in this community, but this is a specific one designed to really empower women who maybe not be comfortable otherwise, may not be used to running, maybe going through a life change. So that's what that's about.
Awesome. Now, our second group here was the Home Sweet Home Ministries organization. And obviously, Home Sweet Home Ministries is pretty well known, but can you get into a little bit of the specifics about maybe what they're looking to improve in their organization?
Sure. And we've actually done projects for them before. This particular project is helping with Mission Mart. So many of you may know that Home Sweet Home Ministries has Mission Mart, which is a place where anyone can donate items. They are sold, and those funds go towards supporting the homeless shelter. They are wanting to look at for special items that might have a unique value, higher value, doing an online auction for those. So what this project team is doing is researching what platforms are available, what's the feasibility, and because, as I talked about, we always want to have sustainability, they're looking at what structures does Home Sweet Home have in place, or would they need to have in place to make it a sustainable plan. If they create an online auction, then how could that be carried out to help the Home Sweet Home Ministries organization really get the maximum out of the donations that they receive?
Salvation Army is another organization that's pretty well known. So on the Bloomington Normal level, I know the project plan here says that they are hoping to develop a training video. Can you talk a little bit about what this training video would do?
Sure. They have a food pantry where families or individuals can come and get food on a regular basis. And that food pantry has one employee who actually happens to be an MCLP alumni, but it really counts on volunteers to run. And the issue is that if the one staff person is training volunteers, she can't get her work done. It's sort of that vicious cycle we have in nonprofits where we need volunteers, but we also need the capacity to train them. So what that project team has done has gone through the training themselves, gone in and learned how to put together food baskets or bags, however those are. And then they are working with some professionals to create a video training plan so that volunteers will be able to come in and watch a training video, and it will really minimize the staff time so that it can be an efficient use of local resources to help other people, to really increase the number of people who can make use of that food pantry.
Now, the last organization, was it Vladimir?
Vladimir, I am told. The Vladimir Canterbury Sister Cities Association. And this is an organization. It's a trio of cities, Vladimir, Russia, Canterbury, England, and Bloomington Normal. They have a sister cities organization or association that has gone back, I should have looked, but I think it's decades, and they've done medical exchanges, they've had international high school student exchanges, all sorts of individuals who go back and forth between the communities to really help strengthen those ties. Because when you understand people in a country on a personal level, it's not just, ooh, the scary country you hear about in the news, but really get to know the individuals one-on-one, then it really helps promote world peace. So with this organization, they are helping the organization to develop a fundraising plan so they can increase those international exchanges. And I believe that up until now, the funding from that has been, I believe, some from Bloomington and Normal, but then also from the membership fees. And so this will be developing a fundraising plan so they can really increase that.
We talked about all of these organizations and the work that the class is doing for this year's Multicultural Leadership Program. How are they gaining leadership experience in these roles?
You know, I'm glad you asked that, because in the classroom setting, they meet twice a month. And they have classes on everything from emotional intelligence to systems thinking, change management, all sorts of leadership topics. A big one that they really like is crucial conversations. But what happens is when you go back to your workplace, it can be kind of awkward to try out a new skill. So crucial conversations, it's a specific strategy you can use in a difficult situation. So when I went through as the director of Faith in Action, if I wanted to go back to work and say, I'm going to try a crucial conversation on you, that's just very awkward and not natural. But in your project team, because you are specifically placed with people who have very different decision-making styles than you and backgrounds than you, when you run into conflict, you can say, all right, let's pull out our book and try that crucial conversation. So it's a safe space. It's sort of an incubator for people to practice those skills that they're learning in class.
After graduation, how do you hope that this project impacts the lives of the classmates?
So there are so many ways that the Multicultural Leadership Program makes a difference in our community. Through each of the nonprofits, we hope that the work that the teams do will continue to enhance their work and help them to be more effective. In addition, our alumni, we have 217 alumni right now who are serving on nonprofit boards all over the community, and those who've moved away are serving around the U.S. We have actually 4 people right now running for local office who are alumni who've just taken their skills and they're going to do that. We have people who are better leaders at work and getting promotions. And interestingly enough, we hear repeatedly that people, their families say that they're better because of the skills that they've learned through here, just how to work with people better and how to lead. So really, it's a real ripple effect that we get from the program.
Mary Cullen reporting with Linda Bolivar, the Executive Director of the McLean County Multicultural Leadership Program. The teams presented initial plans for each nonprofit this week. MCLP participants will work closely with their assigned nonprofit before final presentations occur in March.
My name is Christopher Gallwitzer. I own and operate Night Shop in downtown Bloomington.
And Night Shop is a new GLT underwriter.
We're reaching people who are looking outside of the box for music, people that are educated and know something about conscious eating. GLT is an accessible station with strong followers and open-minded followers. To me, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Learn more about partnering with GLT at wglt.org/corporate-support.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, turning your contributions into grant assistance for local nonprofits in support of the arts, entertainment, wellness, and education. The foundation's annual end-of-year fundraising campaign is currently underway. Details at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a leader of the Small Business Advocacy Council talks about fair maps. Mary Cullen has that story as well. District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says the district is willing to explore the possibility of sponsoring lacrosse sometime in the future, but the McLean County Center for Human Service decision to stop taking new psychiatric clients shows there are greater funding concerns that schools have to consider. Riley also tells GLT's Eric Stock Eastland Mall's big drop in property values likely means the 2% growth in property values the district was projecting to enable a rate cut likely won't happen.
I'm not real optimistic that we're going to see that, unfortunately. If there are things out there that we're not quite aware of that swing it up there, that's fantastic. But realistically, I don't expect to see us hit that 2% mark.
Does it mean likely that what you projected as a slight drop might actually end up being an increase for taxpayers?
No, actually, I think it'll be flat to slightly up, but it's so slightly up that it won't make a difference at all. It's a negligible difference. So I fully expect it to be flat, maybe up about 0.2, 0.4%. Which, in the grand scheme of things, is not going to make much of a difference in the rate.
I wanted to ask you also about the lacrosse proposal that a local club had come to both District 87 and Unified seeking assistance in starting a co-op program. They have come forward online and suggested that. They were told no, but it was a possibility maybe for 2020. Can you give me an indication of what the district's conversations with the group was?
Well, I think that first and foremost, we appreciate opportunities for kids across the board, and lacrosse is a good quality program. The club is doing very well. They're looking to allow for kids to have that opportunity to be a part of an IHSA program. And I think everybody understands that. The challenge that we have, and I'll speak for District 87, is we have many challenges that we face financially. We have many issues that we're not alone in this. There are many districts facing issues with kids that are coming from families that are dealing with trauma, that are having mental health issues, and just things that are not being served to the degree that they used to be in the community, meaning that our social service agencies are not able to provide the services because the funding is not quite what it was in the past. You just saw the Center for Human Services freeze their services. They're not taking on new clients and perhaps have to look at even reducing their existing clients. That's not a good sign. So the challenge that we have is, in the end, potentially funding another program down the road, because the La Crosse folks are more than willing to go out and contribute to that. But down the road, that's a burden that we would take on, and it's coming at a time when it's very difficult when you have these other needs. And so when you prioritize, it's hard to put La Crosse or any other program for that matter that is an extracurricular activity above things that are very much needed for teachers in the classrooms, for activities that revolve around those very issues of trauma and mental health, when the funding is simply not there. So those conversations will continue.
How much of the money would the club have to raise as a starting point, and would they have to provide some sustainable mechanism?
Well, those discussions are going on with them. We don't have a set fixed amount or number. But the reality is we don't have any other program that relies solely on an outside source to fund, and that's troublesome for us. Quite frankly, we don't want that. We don't want to have to rely on outside sources to keep a program going. We want to be able to sustain that. I don't see that as very appropriate. I'm not talking about those things like booster clubs that will contribute to various things to help support it, but for an outside source to totally fund it is just not realistic. So be that as it may, we'll continue that conversation with them, and I don't expect that we'll have an answer until probably late in the spring.
And lastly, what impact has the Center for Human Services and their funding cuts had for District 87?
Well, it's hard to say at this point, only because it's been very recent. But I can tell you that the reduction in services in the community, that has had an impact. And it's not just in District 87. We're not alone. This is affecting many out in the community, and it's not just school districts. So it's a very real issue. It's affecting teachers in the classroom. It's affecting building principals. It's affecting other staff as well. And we're trying to figure out how to best use our resources to be able to meet the needs of kids coming in to our classrooms. But, you know, you heard Dave LaFrance tonight talk about Oakland and how he has kids that are coming from homeless backgrounds all the way to kids coming from gated communities. That's a very diverse mix of kids. And for kids who are coming from households where they have very little, it's sometimes very difficult to address higher levels of academic achievement when you're working on very basic needs. And right now, we're seeing a lot more of having to take care of those very basic needs of kids. And that is our first and foremost priority. It's draining on staff. And it comes at a time where, you know, we're not flush with tons of resources. So that's something that we continue to have discussions on. And as, you know, the state continues to look at funding, my hope is that they continue to consider those type of factors into making sure that we school districts do get additional funding to address these needs.
Is there a possibility that some additional funding will come for this, or will it be more of a reallocating of resources that you already have?
Well, right now it's just simply trying to find places where we can reallocate or adjust or use grant money. Down the road, I'm hopeful that our legislators and our governor really look to increase funding for public education. That's needed, it's necessary, and it's even more important today given these external factors that are playing out.
That was District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley talking with GLT's Eric Stock. Oakland Elementary Principal David LaFrance and his wife tell the school board the Bloomington school has more than 100 students who have a language background other than English. In fact, 27 languages are represented at Oakland Elementary. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Illinois Symphony Orchestra gets in the holiday spirit. The leader of the Small Business Advocacy Council says the nearly 800-day-long state budget impasse set small business up for a rocky relationship with the Illinois government. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with SBAC President Elliot Richardson about policy changes the organization would like to see to benefit the small business community.
The budget impasse was very difficult for the small business community on multiple levels. There were a lot of small businesses that weren't paid money that was owed to them because of the budget impasse, but on top of that, it really eroded the confidence that the small business community had in our government, their ability to work together and solve problems, and Illinois needs significant problem solving right now. So it was a very bad thing for the small business community overall.
One of those issues in regards to faith in government in Illinois is redistricting. And we have a long drawn history in Illinois of gerrymandered districts. And can we talk about how redistricting the maps would at least make a difference for the small business?
Politicians should not choose their voters. Voters should choose our politicians. And when small business owners in the small business community feel they do not have a voice because their vote doesn't matter, they're going to be very remiss to grow and to expand. So fair maps, putting an end to gerrymandering, will do a tremendous amount to instill confidence in entrepreneurs to expand in the state of Illinois. It's the right thing to do, and it's something that should move forward.
Illinois is now, after J.B. Pritzker was elected to office, is very much a Democratic-controlled state. And with the Democrats in charge, what are the chances that they're going to redistrict the maps in a fair way to include Republican votes?
Well, the governor-elect has talked about redistricting in a positive way and reforming redistricting in a positive way. So we feel we have to push hard. We have to hold everybody's feet to the fire so that districts are drawn in a manner which is contiguous, which makes sense, and which includes all voters. And that can be done through an independent commission, and maps can be drawn fairly. So for us, the new administration doesn't matter. We're going to continue to push hard for redistricting reform and try to bring everybody along with us.
The broad view when it comes to having a fairly districted map, how is that beneficial when it comes to drafting policy that would be for the benefit of small business?
You know what? It makes politicians beholden to their constituents, not beholden to party leaders. And that's the most important thing. I mean, if you're in a district and you're a politician and it's so safe that you don't have to strongly support a good small business initiative, then you might not. So what this does is it puts the power in the hands of people to move their politicians to support good public policy.
You also talked about pushing workers' comp legislation in 2019. You say Illinois is improving when it comes to workers' comp, but there's still more work left to do. Can you talk a little bit about the initiatives that you would like to see taken in place in regards to workers' compensation?
We'd like to see, you know, proportional causation, which is done in the majority of states. We'd like to look very hard at that. We'd like to look at other ways to bring down workers' compensation costs, but the most important thing is to bring all stakeholders to the table and to talk about, all right, what can we do to improve workers' compensation premiums in the state of Illinois in a way that isn't unfair to anybody? And you can do that. You can bring stakeholders to a table where people will treat each other fairly for better policy. So we're going to keep workers' comp reform on the agenda, and we're going to look for ideas from all different stakeholders and ask that we continue to explore comprehensive reforms that will improve workers' comp premiums.
And now, along with bringing all those stakeholders to the table, are there any specific aspects that you would like to see as the SBAC included in workers' compensation legislation?
We want to take a hard look at the causation standard. And I know that that's very politically difficult to do, and we don't want to do it from a partisan perspective. There's ways to look at causation in a fair, nonpartisan way that we think would improve the business environment, but also be fair to injured employees. So that's something we'd like to take a hard look at with all stakeholders.
We hear a lot about pensions in Illinois, that's for sure. What changes were included in the 2019 budget that you see as beneficial to pension reform for the future of Illinois?
So something that was very good is eligible individuals are given the right to buy out portions of their pension if they want to do it. And if they want to do it is the key word there, because that makes it constitutional. So they're talking about bringing down the pension debt significantly by allowing vested retirees the ability to take some money out now in a lump sum to bring down the overall pension debt. Now we'll see how that works. We'll see how many people take that voluntary offering and take advantage of that. But we have seen folks do it in Missouri, and we think that they can do it here as well.
For our listeners, can you explain how that would benefit the small business?
Well, look, the pension debt looms over the small business community and everybody in Illinois like a dark cloud, right? So this is a structural issue that needs to be reformed so that people feel better about growing in the state, and they're willing to say, listen, I see my business here for 10 years. I'm going to invest in my infrastructure. I'm going to invest in employees because I think Illinois is beginning to get it right.
And then building off of that, you mentioned how that could even stop people from leaving Illinois. Can you get into that aspect, how we're seeing an increase of out-migration?
Folks are leaving the state of Illinois, and that could be for a variety of reasons, but you hear people talking about it's just a lack of confidence in our government to improve our business climate. So by tackling these structural issues that we've talked about during this interview, what that does is that makes folks, again, feel like, maybe I'm going to stick around. I'll stick it out. I'll grow my business here, because if I'm paying my taxes and if I'm doing the things that I need to do to help improve the Illinois economy, I feel that politicians are going to do the same. They're going to work hard to improve our economy and make that a welcoming place for me to grow my business.
That's GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with president and co-founder of the Small Business Advocacy Council, Elliot Richardson. Richardson spoke this week at the McLean County Chamber of Commerce's Economic Vision Luncheon. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Welcome to the Christmas season. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra puts on its Holiday Pops concert tonight at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Music director Ken Lamb drops by, as he often does before concerts, and says the challenge is to honor the sentiment of the holiday while keeping the interpretation of the music fresh.
Holiday is so much about community and families, and this year one of my goals is to really engage the community. So we're bringing together a lot of groups to share the music together. The Bloomington Normal Youth Symphony will be joining us on stage in a side-by-side. This is a very nice experience for the students, because they get to sit with the professionals. And what's interesting is they don't sit on the inside. We let them sit on the outside, in the string players.
Good for grandma's iPhone.
I think so. And I always joke, because it's the only time in the year that our concert master has to turn pages.
What do the kids learn? How does mentoring happen?
We have a rehearsal, and that's a very important part of the process. Of course, the actual performing, it's incredible. It's very empowering for the young people, but a lot of the learning is done in the rehearsal. So for instance, last night I went to their rehearsal and conducted them for about an hour and a half or something like that, and really just work on musical things and getting to know them a little bit, so get their nerves out a little bit. And then there's a rehearsal with the Illinois Symphony. A lot of times when you work with professionals like that in a side-by-side, all you have to do is to ask the professional to play something for them. And they learn by, okay, well, that's what I hear. They actually get to hear what it sounds like. And without even telling them, oh, you have to play this longer or shorter or louder, softer, they immediately get what it feels to play. And it just the fact of sitting next to somebody and playing along with a professional, that already will lift their level.
Who are the choral and dance groups associated with this concert?
The dance group is the Twin Cities Ballet. They are going to be dancing Nutcracker. We've collaborated with them before, and it's always very, very nice for ballet companies to dance with a live orchestra, because it's a little bit different. A lot of times they dance with a recorded soundtrack, and every time it's the same. But with a live orchestra, that's where the sort of artistry becomes alive, because you have to adjust. The music has to adjust to the dancer to adjust to the music. And it's a very, it's a really great experience.
And the choral group?
This year we have a boy soprano singing. So we don't have a large group. And in fact, a big choral group is something that I'm looking at for next year, but I'm sort of going around and scouting out potential partners in that. We are doing The Snowman, which is a very well-known children's book in England. And this year is the 40th anniversary of that book. And there's a nice soundtrack to go with it, and it's very touching and also very happy. And it features a boy soprano singing a very lovely solo in the middle.
We're walking in the air.
About the classic animated film, how does that mix with the music?
The music was written with narration, and then the cartoon came along. You don't actually have narration, but you have the song in the middle, and you watch the cartoon. But, you know, with movies, usually there's what we call a click track. So the conductor and the musicians wear headphones, and the headphones go click, 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 and then you sort of beat along, because it then goes with the animation. But this one doesn't have a click track. It's a challenging thing to line up, because there are moments where the music has to fit the action. But the music is really, really quite glorious.
So in the U.S., there are several holiday movie staples, from A Christmas Story and A Wonderful Life to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to The Grinch Stole Christmas, you name it. What has made The Snowman a classic in Britain?
I grew up in England. I've been watching The Snowman for a long time. It just seems that every Christmas is on. And I think it's just a really cute movie. It's a wonderful tale of a young boy and his dreams and, you know, his relationship with the snowman, which comes alive and brings him to this other land where he meets other snowmen and had a good time. But the thing is, you know, at the end, as all the good things have to come to an end, the snowman melts during the day. And it's the whole thing ends with a sort of, kind of feeling. But I think it's just a very cute animation and very, very beautiful music. And the song, it's very humble.
Holidays are a time for children. How are you trying to approach children before the concert, other than The Snowman?
Well, the Symphony Guild, the Bloomington Guild, it's organizing pre-concert activities for our audience, and especially for the children. And we're giving away, I think, 50 Snowman books to our audience. So I think it's wonderful. So you come a little early, and then you enjoy the festivities before the concerts.
And you're also performing a Christmas overture. Who's the composer? And tell us a little bit about that.
Hess is a British composer. And the well-known choral director and composer, John Rutter, I think, commissioned this piece. And It's a beautiful medley of Christmas tunes, and it's actually, you know, challenging to play. So the orchestra gets a workout as well. But it's done, as with a good medley, very artfully. So all the themes sort of go in and out of one another, but you'll hear a lot of tunes that people know, and we're going to open the concert with that and to set the tone.
ISO Music Director Ken Lamb making the traditional new. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Eric Stock and Mary Cullen. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.